Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur in the Duck House Studios in Oxford, Mississippi. It is Friday. Joining me on the other end of the line, Spence.
Good morning. How are you,
morning?
Sir? I heard one gobble, and he was in another county. He might have been on another planet. He was a long, long ways away.
You got a big weekend coming up this weekend.
Yeah, we do. We do. This is the Tennessee youth season. And we got a bunch of little kids that are fired up. We're gonna do a big turkey camp tonight and tomorrow night. And I've got 12 kids that are coming with their dads, and they're all gonna go hunt their own stuff. But we're gonna cook for them and try to add to the excitement of turkey season by giving them a bunch of other little kids to run around and goof off with, shoot guns, and I got them all some binoculars, some knives that we can keep from stabbing somebody in the stomach or shooting somebody this weekend. It'll be success.
Hey, you flip-flop. You kind of flip-flop back between Mississippi and Tennessee. Tennessee, yeah. A couple of weeks behind Mississippi, usually.
Yeah, I think so. Everybody talks about behind or ahead, and I think that it's more. I don't know that there's like a real good schedule, you know, from south to up to north. I think that turkeys. I think that gobbling turkeys get each other fired up, worked up into a frenzy, and I think if you got a bird on your farm that's just ignorant and gobbles every breath, that he can get all the other birds on that farm gobbling if he's, you know, waking up and ripping the roof off in the mornings. It'll make all the rest of them want to gobble. But if you don't really have one of those birds, I think sometimes they'll stay quiet on the roost or just gobble once or twice when they're still, you know, they may have hens with them to fly down and still have a group and be full tilt breeding activity, just not necessarily needing to gobble, if that makes sense. So I think it's hard to peg it based on time. 'Cause like, I can tell you this morning, one of my buddies was around Grand Junction and, he hadn't heard a bird gobble in a couple days. It's been real slow. And all of a sudden this morning, he's got about 10 different birds gobbling. Well, those birds didn't just show up last night, you know, and roost on his place. They've been there. Something just got them fired up this morning, started gobbling. And, you know, consequently, I'm about in the same area. My farm's not far away that I'm hunting this weekend. And I didn't hear a bird gobble this morning within 3/4 of a mile, I don't think. And I know they're there. They got to be. They don't, you know, the river's out, so it's not like there's anywhere else for them to go. It's one of the only high spots around. So, you know, I think they get each other fired up as much or more than like, I don't necessarily think it's like, okay, it's time here, so every bird's gobbling, and they're, you know, I don't know if that makes sense what I'm saying, but I guess the main thing I'm trying to say is I think you could have peak breeding behavior going on And that doesn't necessarily equate to a whole bunch of crazy hot goblin turkey, you know?
Some guys
don't gobble a whole bunch. But it's, you know, seems like places where you just hear a million of them gobble, there's always one ignorant turkey on that farm that just loves to talk too much. He's usually the first one to die.
Well, you hunted in Alabama last week, was that, or this week?
This week, a couple days this week. Went down and hung out with my buddy Jared, and I witnessed one being missed, and I witnessed one being killed. And I witnessed another couple close calls and heard a lot of gobbling, and we had a good couple days.
I was going to say, I saw one, I remember one dead picture.
Yep. We're finally getting a pretty stretch of weather, you know, just high pressure and clear skies and sunshine. It kind of makes you feel like spring. All this rain has kind of had me dragging, and I'm glad that even though it's still cold outside, I'm glad to see stuff starting to green up just a little bit and change this last week and a half or so.
Oh, man. Well, last week we left the story with, I remember a few of these highlights. We were talking about R&T had released the Mondo, which, you know, in my mind, I thought it was bad, and you told me different. You know, it's a good thing because a lot of people are going to try a lot of different cutdowns.
Heck yeah. Competition is always good, man. Just like in the waterfowl world, when you have a brand like Sitka that comes along and kind of pushes the envelope, and it pushes everybody, the other brands, the Drakes and Bandits and the other brands to not necessarily like keep up or catch up, but that's not really fair to say to those other brands, but I think it provides a new sense of motivation for everybody to kind of think outside the box. And so you need that. Every industry needs to have people and companies that are coming along every few years and pushing the envelope. And it's everybody's job to kind of keep up. And I think that in business, you got two choices. You can fret about what your competition is doing and badmouth them and talk negative of them, or you can watch what they're doing and be motivated to try to be the best you and be better, you know, and hate towards another brand doesn't really accomplish anything. It just makes you inwardly focused and self-absorbed. And we tried to keep that posture towards R&T. I mean, Mr. Butch was a pretty good friend of mine. We talked pretty often and I thought the world of him. And I don't have that kind of personal relationship with John Stevens, but I have great admiration for what they have done with that brand, and I always have. And so, I don't know, I approached it from a standpoint of these guys do something different than what we do. And anything that we all do that makes the industry better really helps each other. I think that, specifically with regard to the Mondo, when it came out, my stance was, you know, that definitely helped me sell calls. And I felt like that me selling a $50 cut down helped them sell calls. You know, I felt like we both helped each other. And I've always wanted to know what the statistics were on how many people, I'd love to know how many people have bought a Mondo in their lifetime that have also bought one of my calls. And I bet there's a correlation there. I bet there's a lot more correlation there than with people that have, say, bought a Rich and Tone original and then bought one of my Swamp Foxes, or a Daisy Cutter and then bought one of my Beasts, or vice versa. You know, I bet there's a correlation there with the cut down. And so, from a competition standpoint, you know, there were a couple other brands in the business at the time. There was, Mike Fleeman out of Little Rock was making a molded cut down called the DFB, and he had a really, really strong following early on, and still does, has a lot of fans. It didn't seem like a ton of competition, but it was kind of fierce competition for a real small piece of the pie there at first. And not trying to toot our own horn, but we tried really hard to be cordial with everyone and not be enemies with anybody. I felt like that for the duck call business, for the duck call industry, that if we could all be friends, that it helped everybody. And I think that if you look at like an average duck hunter's, cabinet in their gun closet or in their mudroom, man, they got Echoes in there, and they got RNTs in there, and there'll be a full, goose, duck call, a timber rattler or whatever, and a grounds goose call. And like, I always felt like that all of us promoting our different brands, if we did it in the right way that didn't polarize one another, it was good for everybody. Duck hunters always want to buy a different call. And so I always felt like that was a good thing. Not everybody saw it that way, but I did. And I felt like it really helped our business.
Let me ask you this. At that point, you were the new kid on the block.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you got, I guess I'm not asking you personally, do you think, but there was people that didn't know you. You hadn't been in the business. And there were, at your beginning stages, negative rumblings about you and Rolling Thunder. If I'm going to conduct
this
interview,
but go ahead.
I'm not trying to, but if I'm going to interview and get this story right, you know, in the background, you were getting kicked around some because you were the new guy.
A little bit, but
let me say this. And you guys were going out there, you and the few guys that were with you at that point, were going out there and kicking some ass in the public woods, killing ducks. And I think is probably what drove some of it, the negative talk about Rolling Thunder, the Rolling Thunder guys. Never forget the first time I heard that.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you that I didn't hear a lot of negative chatter. I never felt like there were a bunch of people that hated us. I felt like some of the other, there was a lot of tension between kind of our group, my group, and some of the guys in Fleeman's group.
I'm not saying hate. I'm saying jealousy and that jealousy bred negative talk, whether it was gossip or not.
Well, I don't know. I don't have much to say about that. I guess all I'm getting at is that I never felt like there were people that didn't like us or didn't. I don't know. I felt I was very welcomed and accepted into the industry. And in fact, I would go so far as to say there are a number of people, and I can rattle them off by name, that were far kinder to me than I could have ever deserved. And so for whatever little bit of negativity that there was out there, I mean, whatever. It's not a big deal, I mean, I probably deserve some of it, But my theory was always that, you try to make a decent product, a good product, and you try to sell it for less than what somebody's perceived value of it is, so that you're not selling something that's cheap, but you're giving somebody a good deal. And you're upfront with them, and you're honest, and you're willing to stand behind your product, no matter what happens to it. And then you try to be kind to people along the way. And I mean, most of the time it works out. And I'm not saying I've always been kind to people. I mean, I've gotten into plenty of shouting matches in the public woods and whatnot. But I mean, one of the things that we did from early on, one of the principles, kind of guiding principles behind Rolling Thunder and how we founded the company, was we were always going to hunt. And I know that sounds really simple and simplistic and, like, maybe doesn't make sense at first blush, but the first thing the people in the industry would always say to me, other call makers and other, you know, companies that sold to the hunting industry, they would always say, man, you know, it's fun to work in the industry, but dang, you know, it'll sure keep you from hunting. And I would look at them and very naively say, it'll never happen to me. And they'd laugh and they'd go, okay, you know, call me in a few years when, you know, when they're eating your lunch because they can't get calls at Christmas time. But it's a little thing, but I made an agreement with my wife and just, you know, a guiding principle was I was not going to be one of those guys that spent November and December and January sitting in the shop tinkering. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but by God, I felt like if I made a product, I should be willing to go out there and hunt with my product, and I should be, you know, public, and I shouldn't be hiding from anybody or hunting some exclusive private place. I mean, that's great. I appreciate the invitations, all that kind of thing. But like day in, day out, I felt like part of my job, if I was going to sell a call to the industry, I felt like I owed it to the industry or owed it to the people I was selling to get out there and bust my butt just like they were, because I'm no different. I mean, I'm just a regular dude, puts his britches on the same way everybody else does. My waders leak from time to time. You know, I mean, and I want to kill a limited ducks just as bad as everybody else. Like, that's who I am. It's who I was. And the only thing I did different when I had a call company was I tried to carry around some extra calls in the truck. I tried to carry around a box of hats all the time. And so through those early years, I just felt like, you know, if somebody bought one of my duck calls and they were willing to put it on their lanyards, then by gosh, I'd give them a hat. And so, you know, I do little things. I think what I'm getting at is I think being a part of the public duck hunting scene in Arkansas, people, they might say something, you know, in passing on the internet, but there was very little of that even. But when they see you and they realize that, like, you're out there doing the exact same thing they're doing, you know, it just, like, I don't know, it may not be the right way to say it, but they – I guess they accept you and they appreciate what you're doing. I mean, and when you're, you know, when you're sitting in the boat at the ramp and you're waiting on your buddy to back the trailer down, you're like, look over, and, you know, there's two guys in the boat next to you and both of them have one of your duck calls on the lanyard. Like, that's really cool. And so, you know, I'd keep a box of hats. I'd go up to those guys and give them a hat and just say, hey, man, I want you to know I really appreciate that duck call right there came across my kitchen table before it went in the mail. And, I mean, you know, I really appreciate, you know, buying one of my duck calls. Here's a hat. And can you still hear me? I'm going through a valley.
Yeah, got you now.
I think that kind of I think approaching it with that kind of positivity goes a long ways. And I mean, I sure didn't do it right every day. I mean, I had bad days and I got beat to holes and gotten shout matches and all that, but I tried really hard from day one, make sure that I was participating as a blue collar normal hunter, just like everybody else, just like the audience that I expected to buy my product, just like no different than if you were, you know, raised Angus cows, you'd probably, you know, it'd be hard for you to raise Angus cows and be a vegetarian. Like, you know, you need to eat a good steak probably 4 or 5 times a month. That's just fair, you know, to the people that buy from you. And I don't know. But I will say one more thing. Kind of got me rambling and preaching, but I made the comment a minute ago that there were a lot of people in the industry that were extremely kind to me. And I don't know why. I don't feel like I earned their kindness, but I am deeply grateful for their kindness. And Mr. Butch was one of those people. Mr. Butch was very kind to me, and I sought him out. I was introduced to him in Stuttgart early, maybe the first fall that I went to Max and tried to rep calls, and I took him one of my duck calls and showed it to him, and he said, "What the hell is this?" and I said, well, it's a, you know, it's my version of a one of the old PSLs. Oh, goddamn, all y'all think they need to blow hard and cut down, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he kind of knocked it around, and I said, well, you know, Mr. Butch, I just, you know, he said, well, what do you want me to say about it? And I said, well, I don't want you to say anything. And I said, I just want you to look at it, and I want to be your friend, and I admire what you've done, and, you know, I guess the main thing I want you to know is that I tried to be original, tried to do my own thing, and, you know, and, you know, if you keep this call and mess with it a little bit, you know, if you got any pointers for me, man, I'd sure be, willing to learn, and mostly I just want to be your friend. And he kind of laughed, and he was like, you know, he didn't say much, and, you know, then a week later he called me back, and we just kind of became friends, and through stuff like that. And I can tell you that Jim Ronquest kind of did the same thing, but he initiated conversation with me. The first time I walked up to the call counter at Max, I'd never met Jim before, and, I mean, I'm a good bit younger than him, so I'm 37. I don't know how old Jimbo is, but I bet he's pushing 50. And,
I bet he's 80, 85.
Well, we don't measure him in duck wife years.
I'm just kidding, Jimbo.
Actual birthdays. But my point is that, you know, I mean, so this was 9 years ago when 2010 was when we first started selling calls. So in 2010, I would have been 20, I'm 37 today, I would have been 28. Okay, so Jimbo had been, you know, a public figure on television and a world champion caller and all those things. He'd been that for a while. Like, he was he's a big name, in my opinion. And so when I pulled up to Max, I mean, I was intimidated and didn't know. Man, he was the first person when I walked up to that call counter. He stuck his hand out and he said, "Hi, Spencer. It's nice to meet you. I'm Jim Ronquest." You know, and spoke to me and shook my hand. Man, I felt like $1 million. I walked away, called my wife, and I was like, "You wouldn't believe this. Jim Ronquest spoke to me." And, I mean, it was like he was just kind. And he didn't have to be like that, you know. I mean, I was up there behind the call counter trying to sell duck calls to the same people he was. And granted, when you stand beside Jim Ronquest and he's selling duck calls, can I put that in a box for you, partner? He sells a lot more duck calls than my can I put that in a box for you, partner. But we're still vying for the same customer, and he didn't have to be nice. He didn't have to speak to me. He could have turned his back and, you know, stayed busy and you know, halfway ignored me, and he didn't. And I've always appreciated that. I've always admired that about him. And I can tell you several other names. Rusty Creasy was that way at Max and at other stores. He was very kind to me. And several of the other Echo guys, including Mr. Rick. I don't know Mr. Rick very well, but we've spoken on the phone several times, and he has always treated me with far more respect and class than I have ever deserved. All of those guys have. And I'm sure I'm leaving out, you know, some other names, but my personal opinion about kind of the mumblings and whatever, because when you first come out, like, the first thing everybody's going to say is, "Oh, God dang, he copied somebody. You know, he, you know, that's a so-and-so. He got a so-and-so, and he liked it, and he da-da-da-da-da-da." And that is, like, the most ignorant thing that anybody could ever say about a duck call, because it is so hard. Like, if people that said that, I'm not saying it's not possible to copy a duck call, but if people that said that had any concept of how difficult it is to actually copy a duck call, they would never say that. They would realize how asinine it is. I mean, it takes an extremely talented machinist to make a direct copy. Now, you can scan a call. You can make a 3D model of it exactly the same. Buddy, there's 15 tools on a CNC machine. And you can have all those tools dialed in, and you can have all your acrylic rod, you can think it's the same, and one rod's 4 feet long and an inch and a and and a half in diameter and perfect the whole way. And the next rod's 4 foot long, 2 inches, and it's 1.507983 in diameter. And you can turn that machine on one day and it wake up and it's in a different mood than it was yesterday, and nothing changed. Not the temperature in the room, not the color of the material, not the rod in the spindle holder. I mean, it can all be the same and still turn a different call. It's just, it's not, it's a cop-out, and it's an ugly thing to say, you know, oh, he copied so-and-so. People try, but now I'm rambling again. But my whole point is that's like that's the number one thing people say when a new call comes out is, hey, you know, that's a so-and-so copy. Oh, that's a this, that's a that. And those guys could have all done that to me. And those guys carried a lot of weight. And let me tell you, if Jim Ronquest had said, well, that boy right there, he copied a Clifford Fisher, he copied a Kirk McCullough, he copied a Lester Capps, or he copied a what, just any, insert a name right there. He could have probably tanked my whole business from day one. And he didn't. I mean, he was just kind. And I guess I'm dwelling on that for a minute, because I think the world could use a lot more people that act like that, especially with regard to competition, than people that just spew hate. Because, you know, Josh Criswell has always said, and I don't always live this out, but I've tried really hard. I try to remind myself of this, but Criswell always said, if your only way of making yourself look good is by making somebody else look bad, it'll never make you look good. And it's really true. And I found that to be exceedingly true, especially, I mean, with a lot of call companies, but especially with Rich and Tone. Those guys were all kind to me, down to their pro staff, and they didn't have to be. You know, they could have started it from the top and had all their, you know, all their pro staff and fans just, you know, write me out before I even got out of the gate.
Well,
we should check up right there. you asked me about, you know, negative rumblings or things like that, and that's really that's the best response I got to that, is that you know, those guys were kind. They didn't have to be. I didn't earn that.
I'll never forget the first time I asked about Rolling Thunder. And it was not anything that you would, it was one of those, this is way before I even knew who you were, but asking about a Rolling Thunder game call. And you get that high school response where you say something bad about somebody because it's behind, in deep, it's a little jealousy, and you can tell that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason I asked that. That's the reason that I asked that. And like I said, I wouldn't be doing any of this right, kind of weaving both of our steps together through this story.
Sure. You know, there's
all right. So let me ask you this. I want to talk about this for just a minute. Got one more thing, and I'm gonna let you go. But all right, so you release the cut down and you decide that you're going to release some more products like turkey calls. How in the world does that come about? Turkey calls and duck calls are so different.
I mean, they are and they aren't all at the same time. I mean, so how did it come about? The short answer to that is that, I mean, I've turkey hunted since I was 9-10 years old, and it's just part of my life. And I mean, people ask me all the time, like, which do you enjoy more? And the truth of the matter is, I'm just really grateful I don't have to pick. They're different and they're not the same, and they don't come during the same time of the year. And so I think having to discuss picking between the two of them is just silly. That's like saying, that's a false dichotomy. You shouldn't have to choose. Why the good Lord put them at different times of the year. And so, you know, when I started selling a duck call, one duck call, and like I said a couple episodes ago, you know, when we started, these stores like Max and D&W and Hawks and stuff like that, those stores were carrying one item. And if you go into any local of mine, well, if you go into any local sporting goods store, you will be hard-pressed to find a brand that only has one item in that store. In fact, I'll bet you that you can't think of one. Try, off the top of your head, tell me a brand that has just one item in a store.
None that that quickly come to mind.
The only one I can think of offhand is the Shankai Speckle Belly Call. And you go in any store that sells like duck calls and goose calls and stuff, and the Shankai, I think that's how you say it. All them Louisiana people will probably tell me I butchered it. It's written like Cheyenne Killy or something like that. I mean, it's a CH, you know, typical coon ass spelling. But that guy has made a molded speckle belly call, or that company has made a molded speckle belly call, and it's the only item they sell in most of the stores. You won't see other stuff. But every other brand has 10 SKUs or 20 SKUs or, you know, whatever it is. Like, you know, they'll have hats and shirts and clothes and reeds and just all kinds of stuff. And it doesn't matter whether it's a clothing brand or a – and the reason they do that is because it's a lot easier for a buyer to buy more than one product, as many products as possible from one guy. That way he only has to have one meeting and he can fill up 5 or 6 rows of his shelf space. Right? As opposed to if he had to talk to a salesman for each SKU in the whole store, well, that could be 50,000 salesmen in a big store, you know? And so it doesn't work very well that way. And so I learned that real quick, and they told me that. They said, you know, if you're gonna grow this company, you got to build some SKUs. And so while I knew a lot about duck calls, I knew some about turkey calls. I was kind of a nerd about box calls. I really, really liked box calls, and I've done enough woodworking in my life to have an appreciation for how they're built and how they're constructed, and I knew what I wanted to sound like. And so I set out to build a wood box call, and I got help from a number of people who knew a whole lot more than me and were really kind to share their ideas, and I came out with a Turpin-style box call, and that's the box call that we still sell called the Undercut. It's got a undercut body that's big and heavy and loud, and the lid is an oversized heavy Purple Heart lid. Well, there's not another box call on the market like that. There's a Turpin, and Steve Turpin still makes one that's similar. He makes them by hand, and he doesn't, for the most part, he doesn't sell them to any stores. And so while there's similarities between my design and his, I could honestly say when we brought that to market, this is a completely original, unique design. And I owned that. That was our calling card. I told the stores that I worked with, like, look, you know, I don't have 100 SKUs, but I've got 2, and you can rest assured that they're not a copy of anybody's. These are my original designs. Yes, I got help from people, but I mean, who doesn't get some help in their life, right? I mean, that's part of being friends and being in a community. And so I had an anchor in my turkey line, and I had an anchor in my duck line. And from there, with the turkey stuff, that first year I did not come out with a box call. I started dabbling with some mouth calls, but I had that box call by the end of turkey season. And so I killed some turkeys over it, and it did good, and we were tickled pink, and we went about trying to produce them again for the next, a bigger batch for the next spring. And that first batch that we made, there were 100 of them. And so,
just for a little insight, I understand how you can mass produce mouth calls really quickly. Man, how do you mass produce box calls? Just a small insight into that. Just wondering.
Well, it's the same in every industry. There are production shops that don't really have a brand, but that will do production grade work to your specifications. And so if you can design something,
you can basically get it replicated.
Trinkets, or parts.
Yeah, and so it's just a machine shop is all it is. And so for a box call, you know, you have to find a machinist that is willing to run wood on their machines, because it's a mill mostly. And that's no different than what they cut the tone board on a duck call with. And so you have to find a machine shop that's willing to turn wood, that knows how to, you know, and you got to find somebody that can source the wood, and you got to make the woods match, and you got to have a way to finish the wood. And all those things are kind of, I mean, those are the 100,000 foot view, but if you got those things, then you can get somebody to machine a part for you, and then you can finish it, or they can finish it, or whatever, you know, and then you put it together. And so what I did was I found a shop that was willing to machine a prototype. And so I designed in a CAD software with the help of a good buddy of mine what I had some rough handmade prototypes that I liked, and some things like this one I'd like this about, and this one I'd like this about. So I set about with the CAD software to try to take the good from a couple different rough prototypes and build a 3D model of it, and took that 3D model and found a machine shop that would take that design and rough me out a prototype. And I roughed out 50 prototypes from different machines and tweaked them. And you know, they'd build me a prototype, and then I'd tweak it from there. And then they'd build me another one, and we'd tweak it a little bit more. And I mean, I can rattle off 10 call makers that helped me so much with my box call. I mean, one of them is a guy here in Fayette County named Charles Petrie. He makes a box call called the Plain Jane. He's an older man, and he has a machine that cuts the curvature on the underneath side of the lid. And when I was screwing around with prototypes, I could not make my lids play on my boxes like I wanted them to. And I started asking around and said, hey, you know, anybody know, you know, I just asked people that I knew who made box calls around here. And one of them, you know, mentioned somebody, and that person mentioned somebody before long. I'm over at a guy's house that's 75 years old, makes box calls by hand, and he's looking at it and going, you know, well, son, you know, you got a 23 degree curve on this thing, and you need a 47 degree curve. And I'm sitting there looking at him like, what? And he runs it through the machine, puts a different curve on it, comes out, and I'm just standing there awestruck, you know. And I can tell you, Steve Turpin did the same way. I struggled with a few calls that the way they fit together, some box calls, and I called Steve Turpin and said, I need a big favor. And he said, what's that? And I said, I'm struggling like heck with making my box calls play right, and I don't know if I just got a funky batch of wood, or if the machine got off and wasn't milling stuff to specs. And he said, okay. He came over and met me one day, and I bought him, you know, lunch and a couple Cokes. And for long, he tinkered with some stuff and showed me a few secrets and said, you got to swear you won't tell anybody this. And I said, okay. Dang, they're back to playing again. And so, I mean, the honest answer to your question is, man, I got a ton of help from people who knew a whole bunch more than me. And, I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily, I'm not saying that's the way everybody's got to do it, but I just tried to, everything that we've created, I tried to approach from the standpoint of, there's no way that I can be an expert in everything. No matter how hard I try, I'm never going to be an expert goose caller. I'm never going to be a contest turkey caller. I can yelp pretty good, but I'm never going to be on the Grand National stage. I can blow a cut down really well. And so I still try to get opinions and help from people that are willing to help. And frankly, I've asked a lot of my top competitors what their thoughts were. And some of them kind of snub their nose at you and don't really want to help. But surprisingly, some of them are really kind. And what goes around comes around. Sometimes they call and they want help with something, you know, what, like, hey, do you know where I could get some such and such, such and such? And, you know, it when you approach it that way, instead of put a wall up and from a standpoint of hate, there's a lot more that you can learn. And so I realize I'm kind of summarizing now, but you asked me how in the world did I get into box calls from a cutdown, and the short answer to that is you treat people with kindness and you ask people for help, and some people are willing to help you and some people aren't. And you can't get your feelings hurt when somebody doesn't want to help you, but when somebody is willing to help you, you go treat them right, thank them, honor them, you know, and keep what they tell you a secret. and I've had that kind of help in with every single one of my products, every one of my mouth calls, every one of my turkey calls, both the box calls and the pots, and with my goose calls, my honker calls, my lesser call, my speckle belly call. I mean, I didn't just wake up and become a master call maker overnight. I mean, I got help from people that know a whole hell of a lot more than me. And that's not a secret. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know. So, anyways, and the truth of the matter is, everybody gets help from somebody. You know, so you can sit on the folks will sit on the sidelines and they'll be like, oh yeah, you know, he just got so and so, act like it's no big deal. But you know, I mean, just you know, call your competitor and see if they want to help you. Try that on for size. You know.
All right, so this is the plan next week. Comes a point that you have to start mass producing this cut down. You know, you have to make them faster because you're selling a lot more, changing the packaging up. Here's what I want to break into because I think we got a couple more because one of the things I want to end with next week is I'll never forget the first time I saw you online. And what I mean by that is – you started utilizing social media from the standpoint of just kind of breaking into Spence's world. I think it was about 13 or 14. I saw a video of you, and I kind of started following you from that point because of, you know, with Rolling Thunder, Spence, connection, and...
What was the video? Do you remember?
I'll never forget it. It was a video of you just having fun, making fun of yourself with some buddies.
If there's a
lesson to be learned from that, it's not to put on the front, man. Just be yourself. You'll be successful.
There's no doubt about that. I mean, my dad always said you need to be the first one that can laugh at yourself. Otherwise, you'll be the last one, and it hurts. It hurts when you're not the first.
So from that point on, being able to just laugh at yourself on camera, have fun with your buddies, it leads you to the most successful point in all of this, dude. I mean, the Webisodic series is humongous.
Well,
you know, you didn't just go back to like any other hunting company. Just hey, let's make a video of us just killing ducks or killing turkeys.
Yeah.
That's what most do. No.
Yeah.
You showed a side that most don't usually show. Now Dylan has been instrumental in helping you create that. But it's good stuff. Jeez.
Well, I appreciate it. I mean, look, the one piece of advice that I would give somebody, if you're, you know, what little bit you can gather from my story is that, you know, you can only be the best you. No matter how hard you try, you can't be somebody else. And part of growing up and being a mature adult, and a successful citizen in society is figuring out how to be the very best you. And you got to be comfortable in your own skin. You got to know your own faults, and you got to not be threatened by your own faults. And I think in our world today, we raise our kids in a way that's kind of it threatens them if they do something, if they mess up. And you got to be able to fail and it not be the end. You know, you got to be able to fail. And I'm not very good at that as a parent, but man, my parents were really good at that. And that, you know, being comfortable in your own skin, figuring out who you are and figuring out who God made you to be and being the best you that God made you to be. I mean, that's no matter what industry you're in, no matter what business you're in, that's what makes you sleep good at night. And it's what I believe it's what allows you to be a positive contributor to society. You know, it's what makes somebody else in your industry go, man, thank you for saying that, or thank you for doing that, or, you know, that was encouraging to me, or whatever. That's what we all need. We all need to be the better us, you know, instead of trying to be somebody else. And for good and bad, you know, one of the bad things about social media is it makes us want to be somebody else. You know, it makes us want to portray an image that is not reality. And
I think that's the main reason that I followed you back then. You know, yeah, I knew the Rolling Thunder name, knew of it, and then connected the dots between you and Rolling Thunder. But you're just a regular guy, man. And that's why I started following you way back when. But we'll jump off into that next week. Spence, I know you got a lot to do today. Thank you again. Great part of the story. I want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.